are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, November 7th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks. On a Michael Thursday, this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Mohammed Janad, professor of anthropology at Massachusetts College of Arts. We're talking about Kashmir, what the Modi government has done, the role of Kashmir in peace and security in South Asia. Is there a role for China as an underreported crisis deepens on the subcontinent? Letter released today on the eve of a Supreme Court decision in Brazil that may be delayed again, or it may finally release political prisoner Lula da Silva. Accusations of irregularities have not been proven, but the crisis accelerates in Bolivia after Evo Morales' election to a fourth term. Some people doubted it for some reason, but Bernie Sanders has unveiled, of course, the most left-wing comprehensive immigration plan, the only candidate to call for a full breakup of ICE and the CPB. Time to break up Facebook, Sanders says, after leaked documents showed the giant social media, Facebook treated user data as a bargaining chip, apparently to help improve connectivity. Erdogan says that the U.S. is not fulfilling its Syria deal ahead of Trump talks. Two former Twitter employees have been charged with spying for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, digging into accounts of the kingdom's critics and giving all of their personal information to the kingdom. Incidentally, they're charged, but they're both in Saudi Arabia. Bill Gates.
I thought that was McKinsey's job.
Right. Indeed. Bill Gates. It's almost like he isn't actually a positive force in the world. It's almost like a billionaire oligarch will have any tantrum about taxation and threaten to vote.
And maybe make the worst defense of philanthropy that we'll hear all year.
Indeed. Demonstrations to Chile spread. In Iraq, forces murder 13 protesters in a renewed crackdown as the movement against austerity continues. Secret gerrymandering files can now be made public, a court rules. The Republicans plan to suppress the vote. And Trump wanted Barr to hold a press conference saying that the president broke no laws in a call with the Ukraine leader. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Sorry, folks. I think I'm losing my voice a little bit. I'm realizing as
it's going around
as we got into game time. It's weird. I don't feel anything else other than that. Billionaires shouldn't exist. Bernie Sanders gets that. Billionaires are a structural threat to democracy. There is no accumulation of wealth, no matter how quote unquote benign it might be, that does not involve monopoly, worker abuse, market concentration, political rigging, what have you, that could create that level of wealth concentration. It's impossible in terms of reality. For some reason in this country, and Connor Kilpatrick actually just made this point, I think it was an Amber Frost point, if I remember correctly, that the British overclass sort of does a favor because they are so horrifying and gruesome. They actually do things like fox hunting and sort of, you know, look at what Boggs, I think, is that Moggs or Boggs?
Jonathan Rees-Mogg.
Jonathan Rees-Mogg.
Said that the Grenfell Tower people were just too stupid to leave or something like that.
Right. One of the, literally a aristocrat on the Tory front bench is so transparently evil and grotesque that he would say that about the Grenfell Tower. Now, in America, our oligarchs are the same, but they wear sweaters and they talk about philanthropy and they talk about doing good. Now, incidentally, Bill Gates waged a war against public education and teachers in this country, which has been a, well, I think it's been a success in terms of what it was actually trying to do, but certainly not a success in improving education in this country. And he has a creepy and bizarre obsession with African birth rates, which I'm sorry, I find that kind of disturbing. But there has been this delusional brand built in the American psyche that some of these people who look, again, some of them might be perfectly nice people, might even have nice intentions. But in fact, the structural reality of their wealth is antithetical to democracy. And when push comes to shove, most of them are going to vote in accordance with that. So even a absolutely minuscule wealth tax like the one Elizabeth Warren is putting on the table, basically a tax on Bill Gates's couch change. I think the number, I think he's worth at least $20 billion. And I think if at 2%, I think it would be like $100 million, which obviously is more in a lifetime for over 90% of people. But for Bill Gates, I mean, I don't know. He wouldn't even need to sell a jet to chip that off to the federal government. But oh boy, did that lead to a meltdown. And I would say along with all of the photos of him with Jeffrey Epstein, maybe a ongoing mask off moment for Bill Gates.
Now, somebody can say I'm very biased since I've been a prime beneficiary of the existing system. But I'd love to somebody to find a middle ground approach, because the government's role in health care and better education, the government does need more resources than it has today.
And so what would you do?
Well, if you make the tax on capital the same as labor, you go back to the...
Recently, Saez and Zuckman discovered the era of research showed that capital taxes on labor is higher than taxes on capital.
Right.
The idea that we'd make them even is ludicrous. Like, that's
ludicrous.
Not a middle ground.
No.
Capital should be taxed far, far higher than labor.
To put it in simple terms, Wall Street stock speculation by rich people or being a landlord should be taxed at a higher rate than your job.
Tax on capital, the same as labor. You go back to the estate tax that we used to have. Doing something like the 10-year thing, you know, where it's super large fortune. The big fortunes are not, as Piketty says, a return on capital. The big fortunes are the return on creating companies that achieve very strong positions, particularly in the technology industry. That's where you get these super big numbers.
Bill Gates created such a pernicious monopoly in technology that at the end of the Clinton administration, that administration was going after their monopolistic practices. And the Clinton-Gore administration presided over some of the most expansive deregulation of Wall Street and the first late 90s tech bubble. His practices were so predatory and monopolistic that it caught the attention of the late 90s Clinton Justice Department.
You get these super big numbers. I've paid over $10 billion in taxes. I paid more than anyone in taxes. But I'm glad to have paid, if I'd had to pay $20 billion, it's fine. But when you say I should pay $100 billion, okay, then I'm starting to do a little math about what I have left over. Sorry, I'm just kidding.
$6 billion.
So you really want the incentive system to be there, and you can go a long ways without threatening that.
Have you ever talked to Elizabeth Warren about any
I've
of this
not.
Before? Would you? Would you want to?
You know, I'm not sure how open-minded she is. Or that she'd even be willing to sit down with somebody, who has large amounts of money.
Okay, so let me make it complicated for you. You've been, politely say, public about your misgivings about our current president. If Elizabeth Warren were the other candidate, what would you do?
You know, I'm not going to, you know, make political declarations, but I do think no matter what policy somebody has in mind, a professional approach is even, as much as I disagree
this
with
all
the policy things that are out there, I do think a professional approach to the office, whoever I decide would have the more professional approach in the current situation probably will weigh, is the thing that I'll weigh the most. You know, I hope the more professional candidate is an electable candidate.
Yeah, exactly, Bill. More professional approach.
What does that even mean?
Couldn't agree more. It means don't tax him. Jesus, I even get it, Brendan. Now, of course, the other element of why you have we should have a way bigger wealth tax is for the sake of democracy. We'll get to the numbers in a second. I just want to say, Elizabeth Warren, the team sent out an awful tweet saying that she would be happy to sit down with Bill Gates, which is, look, I'm always happy to meet with the people, even if we have different views. Bill Gates, if you get a chance, I'd love to explain exactly how much you'd pay under my wealth tax. I promise you it's not $100 billion. Now, Elizabeth Warren last year refused to go on Fox News for some very well-argued reasons. I don't happen to agree. I think as disgusting as it is the largest cable network, and you're running for president, you're going to be on it. And indeed, Warren was regularly on Fox News before the commencement of the campaign. But she did say, look, I'm not going to go on a racist network promoting Trump's terrorism at the border. And again, I think if you're running for president, you have to go on Fox. And indeed, Bernie did an incredible job on Fox. Pete Buttigieg, and this is really hard for me to say, personally in Fox's studios along with Bernie, criticized Fox's racism and capitalist propaganda, as an example. I think it's very disturbing Elizabeth Warren does not bring the same energy to Bill Gates, who in terms of reality is a way bigger threat and impediment than the average Fox viewer. And of course, the point is to get to the viewers, not the network. The network in this case is the medium, right? So to say I won't potentially reach millions of people, and even if it's only 10,000 people that say, you know what, I like that policy set, I'll vote in a better way. But then all of a sudden, you'll turn around and be kind of obsequious to an obscene oligarch who has basically just revealed that for all of the branding and all the bullshit, that a modest wealth tax is enough for him to at the very least consider voting for Donald Trump. I would say almost certainly he would vote for Donald Trump or come up with some type of like made up stupid, you know, third party campaign that would specifically function as a spoiler, like try to resuscitate Howard Schultz. So, you know, very bad instincts there, in my view, from Warren, and very revealing of billionaires aren't your friends, folks.
Yeah, if a billionaire Gates wants to see Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, he should go to Iowa and New Hampshire.
Exactly. Go on the campaign trail, see if you can get a meeting. Why the hell should they sit down with you? And I think that's the message. You know, why do you get special treatment? Getting special treatment your whole damn life. Bernie Sanders' Twitter said, say Bill Gates was actually taxed at $100 billion. We could end homelessness, provide safe drinking water to everybody in this country. Bill would still be a multi-billionaire. Our message, the billionaire class cannot have at all when so many have so little. That's what it is. And incidentally, not particularly interested in listening to you laboriously try to get through a point about your greed while looking at the, you know, intentionally, like, do you see the holes at the soles of his shoes? Like the whole, like, yeah, I'm just a regular guy. I don't really like to spend. That's it. You know, that's even worse. These billionaires that are like, I drive a used car, I have holes in my shoes. Disgusting. I mean, at the very least, make a little bit of the trickle down work. My God, go buy some friggin' cars. Employ some more people. You greedy morons. Humans have been shaving for thousands of years. But the secret to a great shave hasn't changed much. That's why Harry's doesn't overcharge you to add gimmicky features on their razors. Now, obviously, I have not been shaving much. I've been keeping a beard, but you still got to take care of the neck. You got to trim it. You got to keep things in shape. I use my Harry's razors for that exact purpose. I also have very sensitive skin, and the Harry's works with it, not against it, as so many other razors do. I remember when I first had the Harry's, it was the first shave I ever had where there wasn't any cuts. Now, maybe that's a problem with my form, but I think it also shows really the incredible weakness of so many other razors. Harry's is the blade that I use whether I want a full shave or to help manage the beard I do have. Harry's is a return to the essential quality. Durable blades at a fair price, just $2 per blade. They've cut out the middleman by manufacturing blades in their German blade factory, which has been honing precision blades for a century. That means you get incredible high-quality blades at factory direct prices. There's no risk trying them out. If you don't love your shave, let them know and they'll give you a full refund. Listeners to our show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade to cover your razor to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/majority report to start shaving better today. How you spend your time and what you listen to is totally in your control. Your personal information, however, is a different story. Because when you shop, bank, or browse online, your personal information is getting out there, and you can lose it, exposing you to cybercrime. Thankfully, there's Norton 360 with LifeLock to help you get back a sense of control and protect yourself and your personal information. It's an all-in-one membership for cyber safety that gives your that gives you device security, identity theft protection, and VPN for online privacy and more. Plus, if there's an identity theft related problem, they have agents who will work to fix it. Now no one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft, but Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally to help protect you in today's connected world. All I can say about this is that, and I make this point with anything like this, is that, first of all, you got to do it. Look at these companies, look at how the web works. You got to protect your privacy. I found installing this in all of my devices to be incredibly easy. I didn't even need to ask anybody for help, which says a mind-blowing amount. So get it. Easy as anything. It's downloaded. It's there. Boom. Now I know my information is being protected. Sign up today for LifeLock. Sign up today for Norton 360 with LifeLock membership. And as our listener, you'll save 25%. Or more off your first year at norton.com/majority. That's norton.com/majority for 25% off. And let's also talk about Joybird. Whether your style is more mid-century, modern, or boho, or you're not sure, your furniture should suit your needs while also feeling uniquely you. Need a sofa in a golden hue or a love seat in the hottest red, as Matt has? An inviting baby blue, or even a plush green velvet, Joybird's got your back. Joybird offers a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery options so that your creations can stand the test of time. Plus, all Joybird handcrafted pieces come with a limited lifetime warranty. And thanks to the 365-day home trial, you can sit on it, sleep on it, and break it in. Then if you don't love your Joybird, return it. Create furniture that matches your own fearless style at joybird.com/majority25. That's number 25. See how Joybird can help make your dream space a reality today at joybird.com/majority25. Go to joybird.com/majority25 and receive exclusive offer for 25% off your first offer by using the code MAJORITY25. Thanks, everybody. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Mohammed Junaid. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Professor Mohammed Junaid. He's a professor of anthropology at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Junaid, as you've asked me to call you, professor, as I'm tempted to call you, how are you? Thanks for being here.
Hi, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with Majority Report.
So can you start by just giving us a fresh sort of, we've talked about it on the show, but give us a re-review as to what has happened in Kashmir over the last several months from the government in Delhi.
So for those listeners who don't know Kashmir so well, just wanted to let you know that Kashmir is at the heart of three major countries. All of them have nuclear weapons, India, Pakistan, and China. It's a Himalayan region with a long history. And it became part of this dispute between India and Pakistan in 1947 when the British left the subcontinent, leaving Kashmiris in a state of limbo because they were not allowed to decide their future, whether they would go with India, Pakistan, or whether they would prefer to remain independent. So in the aftermath of the partition in 1947, India signed this treaty with the ruler of Kashmir, who was not a representative figure for Kashmiris. It's called the Instrument of Accession. And based on that treaty, India had incorporated two key articles in its constitution, Article 370 and Article 35A, which became a constitutional kind of link between India and Kashmir. Article 370 was about Kashmir's autonomy, that most of Kashmir's, the decisions that affect Kashmir would be taken by assembly in Kashmir, except for defense, communication, and external affairs. And Article 35A was about land and permanent residency, who could live in Kashmir, who could buy land, immovable property in Kashmir. And then this system has continued for 7 decades almost in a little watered down form. But on August 5, 2019, Indian government withdrew and revoked Article 370 without consulting Kashmir and Kashmiris, and also revoked 35A. All of this was done by kind of what Kashmiris perceive as deceit, because most of Kashmir was put under a severe lockdown. People's phones were taken away. They could not call anyone. They could not connect with anyone. The internet was shut down. So right now we are like 4 months into it, and that process has continued. Kashmiris have not been able to kind of express their opinion on what has happened with these articles.
And what, in terms of how you understand the government in Delhi's move, and you talked about the land issue. Obviously, there is a, you know, sort of the Hindutva dimension, and I'd like you to talk about the ideology of Narendra Modi and the BJP government. But is there also something going on here that maybe, and, you know, bear with me if the analogies aren't perfect, but something that's almost more analogous in some respects to something like Puerto Rico, or another kind of like, there, basically that there's an opportunity to also do a lot of very primitive capital accumulation right now. You can get people off of pretty prime real estate, some of the most beautiful places in the world. I haven't had the privilege of going, but at least even just kind of on a, you know, as I've seen it represented in film and photography, there's ski slopes, there's, you know, there's money to be made, capital to be accumulated. And in the clips of sort of Indian sort of mainstream right-wing media that I've seen, there's certain, you know, there's the sort of stuff you expect with the BJP Hindutva stuff and terrorism rhetoric and so on. But there, I've also seen clips that are like, this is, you know, this is going to be a bonanza. There's great money-making opportunities here. So what's the sort of relationship of what's happening here between a kind of broader nationalist project and consolidation and the identity politics of it and the capital accumulation dimension?
So we are living in a historically a moment when crony capitalism has met this nativist kind of populist nationalism. And it's happening in a variety of spaces across the globe. India is a particularly a potent case for this, because it's the lives of 1.23 billion people that are at stake. Now, let me just like break it down a little bit. The RSS, which is currently the regime that runs India, Narendra Modi is the prime minister, although his party is called BJP, but BJP is just a political front for RSS. Modi himself is a lifelong member of RSS. Mm-hmm. RSS has its roots in 1920s. It emerged as a sort of a nationalist organization, taking inspiration from the rise of Nazism in Germany and fascism in Italy. It believed in Hindu supremacist ideas. It believed in eugenics, and believed that nationalism trumped every other consideration. You know, being Indian is primary over being human. So this is the party that kind of assassinated a member of it. This party assassinated Gandhi, and they were kind of low-lying for a pretty long time, although their ideas kind of were dispersed across the Indian political sphere. But in the 90s, early 90s, when India was going this massive restructuring of its economy, where these IMF prescribed restructuration policies, taking away benefits from people, ending the public distribution system, selling off the national assets to domestic capitalists, all of this kind of coalesced together at that time. And the nationalists supported this domestic accumulation in the hands of few people like Ambanis, the Adanis, the Birlas and Tatas, who were these big industrial houses in India. And these big capitalists kind of like used this nativist national hyper-nationalist discourse to
get rid of these some of these democratic debates, democratic institutions, trying to move, persuade people away from questions of inequality and economy towards fear-mongering, towards creating internal threat. And so all of this has led to a situation where in India, which is probably one of the among the two top most unequal societies in the world, where the top 1% of the population owns basically 75% of the national wealth, where almost three quarters of wealth generated in the economy goes to the top 10% of the people. And, you know, so this inequality has kind of coexisted and allowed this nativist rhetoric to go on. Now, with the revocation of 370 and 35A, the Indian government led by BJP and Modi wants to do two things in Kashmir. One, it wants to demographically change the region by bringing in Indian people who can, like, basically do, you know, come in, turn Kashmiris into a minority, and remove through demographic transformation the question of self-determination, which still remains to be, you know, addressed. A historic demand for, from Kashmiris. And second, and most potently, they want to sell off Kashmir, the pristine lands of Kashmir, which is ecologically very fragile, to these crony capitalists who have been supporting them, who have been funding their elections. So all of that process has already begun.
And so actually, so maybe it's also kind of like, in some ways, analogous to Tibet, in terms of the kind of occupation and population engineering and also a huge amount of ecological resources to be determined, so to be acquired. Let's come back to India in a minute. Let's talk about the other two players here, and let's start with Pakistan. I want to basically just balance. I mean, there's no doubt that obviously the sort of RSS propaganda and the main sort of perspective of justifying this behavior in terms of an international press and people who defend it, you know, they just sort of repeat terrorism talking points. Now,
yeah.
And so, you know, that's important. I know you'll push back and debunk it. At the same time, I mean, obviously Pakistan has actually funded some of these types of groups, even independently of Kashmir, going back to like the attack on the Oberoi Hotel in 2008, that great atrocity. And, you know, India and Pakistan have their own dynamic, which in some ways it seems like Pakistan maybe, you know, has an even more kind of limited foreign policy in terms of its focus really specifically on India. So what is Pakistan's role here, both in terms of what part of Kashmir is in Pakistan and are, in fact, is the human rights situation on the Pakistani side better than on the Indian side or worse or equal? And to what extent has there been, not in the current escalation, I mean, the politics of that is obvious in terms of what's coming out of the nationalist crony politics of Delhi right now, but historically, have some of the groups and some of the things that Pakistan has funded, have they engaged in atrocities?
Yes. So let me first begin by saying that as a scholar of Kashmir, I don't see Kashmir necessarily as a territorial dispute between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Although globally, the discourse on Kashmir has been basically captured by India and Pakistan. They claim mm-hmm. Pakistan claims it to be the unfinished business of partition, and India blames Kashmir, you know, Pakistan for all that is happening in Kashmir. So what Kashmiris have been trying to do from last 70 years is to center themselves and claim that Kashmir belongs to Kashmiris and Kashmiris should be the people who decide their fate and their future. Now, of course, you know, 1947, part of Kashmir came under Pakistani control, which meant that Pakistan became kind of like a party to this question. And there are a lot of regions in of Kashmir that are under Pakistani control right now. So since 1947, India and Pakistan have fought several wars, and most of these wars have taken place over Kashmiri territory, affecting Kashmiris the most. You know, it's the Kashmiris who die in these wars. In 1990, Kashmiris rose up in a rebellion against the Indian control in mass protests, which were brutally suppressed. There were massacres, there's a litany of massacres, really, from 1988 to 1990 that took place in Kashmir at that time, in response to which young Kashmiri activists crossed over the line of control and went to the other side of Kashmir seeking arms training. While the Pakistani government at that time showed lukewarm response to this, they lightly armed them, gave them 15 days training, and sent them back. Most of these young Kashmiris kind of basically died as soon as they came in. Thousands of Kashmiri militants who had barely any training were dying.
Right.
And you have to remember, it is a time also when the Afghan situation is boiling over. Soviet Union left Afghanistan, and there's a war going on between Najibullah's regime and the so-called Mujahideen, who actually win, and many of these militants are then like transported into Kashmir by the Pakistani establishment. And the Pakistani establishment basically sought to create a constituency in Kashmir where the militants kind of, the only ones who had some power would be the ones who would speak the pro-Pakistan language, like that Kashmir should merge with Pakistan. And those Kashmiris, the majority who wanted to be independent and were fighting India for that, were slowly silenced, of course, by Indian repression, but also by Pakistani manipulation. Many of these groups that came into Kashmir were Islamist. They were some of them believed in jihad, some of them even believed in global jihad. But the overall sentiment in Kashmir has been centered on Kashmir. Kashmiris are a pluralistic people. You know, we have a long history of being a plural society with tolerating differences and like our a very progressive past. And in fact, in 1940s, one of the major events was this adoption of this constitution a document called Naya Kashmir, which imagined a progressive, free, democratic, pluralistic Kashmir. That sentiment has remained, and it's at the heart of the Kashmiri struggle for self-determination. Because most Kashmiris believe, of course, that India and Pakistan have not been able to be fair and just to Kashmiris, and India has, of course, failed as an idea for Kashmir. So the only best solution is to basically, you know, chart one's own course and build a society, a pluralistic society that Kashmir deserves.
So, yeah, and this is really important. I just want to underline this. So, I mean, yeah, so international rhetoric and security rhetoric is India versus Pakistan. What is the Indian record there? Does India deserve it? What are the notions of nationhood in India? How does it relate to Kashmir? Then in Pakistan takes, independent actors who want independence and actual autonomy for Kashmir, and then obviously weaponize it for their own nationalistic foreign policy aims. And missed inside all of that is this ongoing reality that Kashmir really is an independent thing with its own autonomous direction and desire, which is suppressed by these two nationalist impulses.
Yeah.
Okay. What is China's role in all of this?
So China's role, first of all, of course, it's, as I said, it's a neighboring country. Its borders meet Kashmir through Tibet, which it occupied in the 50s. And part of the historic territory of what was the state of Jammu and Kashmir before 1947 was taken over by China in 1962 during India-China war. So China has territorial control over part of Kashmir, part of this historic state of Kashmir. China is also an ally of Pakistan, although much of that alliance is built on, like, you know, issuing statements, but not actually being a force on the ground. It has not provided to be a kind of like a stabilizing force in the region, and kind of has strong trade relations with India, although it has strong defense relations with Pakistan. So its role is kind of ambiguous and has not factored in the Kashmir question as one would have imagined.
So back to India, there's another notion which sort of connects what's happened in Kashmir with a broader question about the nature of Indian nationhood. And I want you to clarify, I guess, first of all, that even before this significant escalation by the Modi government, that Kashmir was already a place with decades-long significant human rights violations by the Indian government. But also, is there something to the notion that for all of the imperfections and all of the contradictions in any number of areas, the state of emergency in the 1970s, pogroms against Sikhs in the 1980s, the occupation of Kashmir, that there still is this notion of Indian pluralism coming from Nehru that it, again, at least allows for some of this notion of autonomy in Kashmir. And now in this new state-building project of the RSS, that India is being reconfigured along anti-pluralist, nationalist lines, and that this is a sort of, you know, it's a second founding in a way, and Kashmir is ground zero for that.
So when you look at Kashmir from or India or the Nehruvian project from the perspective of Kashmir from its margins, there is really not that much of a difference. You know, the question of plebiscite or referendum was actually taken by in India itself. International leaders at that time had told Kashmiris that they will hold a plebiscite so that Kashmiris can determine their future. And the betrayal of those promises, as Kashmiris call it, begin almost with Nehru himself. In 1953, for instance, he arrested Sheikh Abdullah, who had endorsed the instrument of accession, and kept him in jail for like almost a decade and a half. And introduced legislation through these things called presidential orders that gradually took away the content of the Article 370. Mm-hmm. So Nehruvian policies from the beginning, while they were pluralistic, almost like, you know, that there was a notion of secular nation building, they were carried out in many parts of India. But you have to also understand that India inherited, these national leaders inherited an empire from the British, and they wanted to turn it into a nation state. And Nehru used the same kinds of colonial policies that the British had used in the subcontinent. I mean, if you look at India from the very beginning, it has been at persistent war with different communities, nationalities, nations, groups and religious minorities from the very beginning. You know, from the bombings in Mizoram, the Armed Forces Special Powers Act in Manipur in the early 50s, to war in Kashmir and arrests of Kashmiri national leaders, to the so-called police action, which was military brutality in Hyderabad, to annexation of Goa, and all of these things have been kind of like continuously taking place. We have argued for a long time that Congress kind of set the template that Hindu nationalism almost, you know, basically adopted. The Congress Party set up that template, and although the rhetoric was secular, the rhetoric was national, where minorities were supposed to be included in different degrees. The Hindu nationalism basically used the same template of imperial control, except that they were going to give primacy to the interests of one community, that's the Hindus. Right.
So now is the sort of where do we go from here question. I think, you know, for an American and a global audience, there is the sort of way of trying to grip people's attention on this, which is, you know, there's so much worry about North Korea, but in fact, like, the conflict between India and Pakistan, and God forbid if India, if China got involved, that this could lead to maybe the most dangerous hot war on the planet. And then there's the other notion of really centering Kashmiri aspiration. So what, I mean, from those two frames, what do you see playing out? And then, you know, I mean, in fact, even what do you think is helpful? I mean, was the Bernie Sanders statement, at least in terms of the the clarity on Article 3, was that helpful? Where do we sort of go from here in terms of the big kind of global threat level and then the urgent level of Kashmiri protection and self-determination?
Yes. So I think that it's a question of different scales. What happens at the regional level and what happens at the global level. At the regional level, of course, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Kashmir has to be centered because it is already at the center of this major conflict that is brewing up. As you said, there's been a recent report by American scientists which basically argued that any war in small war in the region could quickly go out of control and cause millions of deaths around the world and potentially destroy the planet. I mean, we're thinking here of like how these scales are connected. So a solution has to be sought where maybe an international agreement between a trilateral agreement between India, Pakistan, Kashmiris can emerge where Kashmir, instead of becoming this bone of contention between India and Pakistan, becomes like a bridge of peace where, you know, India and Pakistan agree to give freedom to the respective regions and create open borders, create use Kashmir as a trade route. I mean, Kashmir is also at the heart of Central and South Asia. So it's a, I mean, those things can happen at the regional level. Locally, of course, you know, Indian government really needs to open up the communications, free political prisoners, and basically remove military from the civilian areas as urgently as possible because it's a unfolding humanitarian disaster. Now, globally, of course, we are seeing the rise of, this populist nationalism at a time of extreme inequality. We have to, it's not only happening in India, it's happening in the U.S., it's happening in Britain, it's happening in Turkey, it's happening all over the world. And we need to kind of return to the democratic ideals. We need to make our institutions much more representative of people's interests rather than, of a space where these crony capitalists can twist policies that benefit only them. I mean, much of the ground forces of RSS, the stormtroopers of RSS, actually come from low-income, lower-caste communities who feel like, because they have this right to inflict violence over Muslims and other minority communities, they are somehow, they feel a sense of empowerment. But it's not, because they are still grinding under the feet of casteism and capitalism in these regions. So we have to take all a kind of like a holistic approach to all of this, within which a new system has to be built where human rights, people's rights can be center of our focus, and economic justice can be center of our focus.
Absolutely. And it really is. I mean, that is like precisely a global pattern in terms of the dynamic you just described there. Professor Mohammed Janad, professor of anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you for leading us through this.
Thank you. So nice talking to you.
Take good care. All right, folks, there's a lot more to talk about, but we should probably be paying more attention. I think this, when he said destroy the world, I think I want to be specific. In that report, I think the implication was that if they exchanged a certain amount of atomic bombs, it could basically destroy, like, the global food production system because of radiation. And that would be not good.
Yeah, there's a number of books about nuclear sort of precarity.
Right.
Command and Control is one. I can't remember who it's by.
Is that Eric Schlosser?
Could be. At least he wrote one of them.
He's a really good reporter. Fast Food Nation is a good book, too. Yeah.
And that is some pretty depressing reading. Like, that was giving me, you know, when I get post-Trump, I have a lot of these, like, very morbid. It often happens at, like, 11 p.m. at night where you're just like, holy crap,
that's
actually, it's all
time.
Happening.
We're in it.
We're like, we've been joking around, but actually it's happening.
Right.
That before Trump, that used to be where it would come from for me is, oh, we need to do something about these nuclear weapons. Like, even when Obama was in office, it's like, guys, can we just you know, maybe decommission all of these quickly before we destroy the entire planet? And then turns out we're going to destroy the planet in some other way, maybe.
I mean, it's good to think about stuff like that and climate, because it's like, there are these literal foundation things, like, and it's so funny because they're so elemental, because it's literally a question of survival, and then it's also does get to, I mean, for lack of a better word, like religious themes. Like, do we have a right to change the entire topography and climate balance of the planet? Not in some type of extreme deep ecology way, like, no, humans are not going to just fold back into the woodwork. But what is the ethics of completely transforming in every way, shape, and form in a negative way this planet that we inhabit with so many other beings? And then, you know, the nuke dimension. Like, it's amazing how it's like, on one hand, hey, do you want to survive and carry on future generations? That's a pretty simple question. And then the other, like, pretty deep moral stuff around, like, private and public bureaucracies of, like, global destruction that are, you know, that they should be, you know, they're pretty weighty questions.
Yeah, Daniel Ellsberg wrote The Doomsday Machine, which we actually interviewed him for this show.
2018, I think.
Yeah, great book as well.
I remember I went out and I skipped the gym that day.
Yeah.
I think I literally went and just had like a pastrami sandwich, like whatever.
Yeah, it's like that one, The Dead Hand by David E. Hoffman, and yeah, Eric Schlosser's Command and Control. Three great books if you want to really terrify yourself in something besides fascism, basically.
And I'll give some more creative and recommendations for nuclear proliferation. End Zone by Don DeLillo. If you're trying to get into Don DeLillo, that's a quick one and kind of captures the American mind during the age of the nuclear threat, or the height of it, really, I guess, in the Cold War. And then Acid West by Joshua Wheeler. It's a series of essays about New Mexico, and it talks about a lot of it is about the nuclear program in New Mexico. And fun fact, did you know the country that has had the most nuclear bombs dropped on it is America?
Of course.
Yeah.
With the testing.
Not even close. Yeah.
Right.
It's perfectly safe.
Perfectly safe, perfectly fine. Just tell
some sunglasses.
To throw some sunglasses on. Tell them aliens are doing it. it turns into a really different kind of movie, but Hiroshima Monomora, I think it's called. The first 10, 15 minutes of that, the depiction of the bomb on Hiroshima, I think actually specifically too, because it's an old movie, so it's so low tech, but it's absolutely hard. It's almost like seems like it would be more accurate because it isn't like a big, you know, like CGI, like, yeah. Like it's really like
the one in Terminator 2 terrified me.
I didn't remember that one. That actually, yeah. Word. There's this. The last tangent I'll get on, is this the one in Terminator 2?
Yeah, we won't play audio, just...
Jesus fucking Christ.
I remember seeing this when I was a kid, and yeah.
This, I think, was in the Adam Curtis...
This is definitely Adam Curtis B-roll for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this French... Last tangent, this French philosopher whose name I'm forgetting, actually, his whole argument is that we should be talking about these things regularly and enacting them in our imaginations so as to, like, you repress them because they're so terrifying, and then that feeds the actual problem because it's not in your it's like, oh, I don't want to think about it. And then, you know, occasionally it just pops up in the news like, oh, we still haven't done anything about climate. Oh, the Trump administration is tearing up one of the basic building blocks of proliferation control. And his idea is that that those actual cultural acts are actually really important because they bring it to the surface. Like, you should be kind of scared, and then there should be an action that arises from that. It's interesting. But, you know, it's a balance. I was just reading an interview with Cornel West, actually, and somebody was like, you know, like, some people don't want to tune in to, like, the fascism of the Trump administration because it's, like, it gets overwhelming and depressing. And by the way, I do think plenty of people should absolutely get offline and get outside and do other things for sure. And then please do that. But then on the other hand, what Cornel West was saying is, like, not in terms of – he wasn't talking about following the news. He was talking about kind of like absorbing the full weight of what's going on, like kidnapping and putting children in concentration camps and human beings in concentration camps, which is literally what's happening. He uses really spiritual language, which I'm comfortable with, but because I do think it is like it requires a lot of human depth to work with, and there is a certain obligation to it because it's happening.
Yeah, and people, I mean, it might be easy to be dismissive of the importance of representing this stuff on screen, but I also remember, I think it's, is it Rami Malek who's doing a Bond villain, and it's like an eco guy, eco-terrorist or something like that.
We don't need that right now.
Well, Alex Preen pointed out, the writers almost seem like if it was just a fossil fuel billionaire, that's almost too easy or something like that.
There was an old Bond one that one of the new Daniel Craig ones was about this, like some part of it was a company like stealing water in Bolivia.
That's perfect. And that's why Sorry to Bother You was so good, because the way it kept escalating was like it's turning people into like laboring half human, half horse hybrids.
Right.
And like that is actually, even though it's ludicrous and a reductio ad absurdum, as Ben Burgess would say, it illustrates something that's real and how like basically we are all conditioned by these corporations to be better workers. So anyway,
no, 100%. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. And this show is also brought to you by Norton 360. When you shop, bank, or browse online, your personal information gets out there. Thankfully, Norton 360 with LifeLock is an all-in-one membership for cybersecurity. Now, no one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft, but Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally to help protect you in today's connected world. Sign up today for Norton 360 with LifeLock membership, and as our listener, you'll save 25%. Or more off of your first year at norton.com/majority. That's norton.com/majority for 25% off. On last Tuesday's The Michael Brooks Show, we had these shows are humming. The indispensable Adolph Reed Jr., everybody order class notes. We talked about essentialism, the professional managerial class, and just got, you know, his really deep insight. The great Abby Martin joined us. We talked about Gaza. We talked about why Trump is empire. Don't believe all the nonsense about him being some type of quasi-isolationist. Civilian casualties across the globe have skyrocketed under the Trump administration. And the structural problems in Tulsi Gabbard's foreign policy thinking. Then there was a parallel conversation. What are the similarities between the Elizabeth Warren 2020 campaign and the Bill Clinton 1992 campaign? We did some history. And, you know, honestly, when we get to the post game, talking about everything from Maradona to Bolivia with Nando Vila, I try to keep these short. But we cover like a hell of a lot on TMBS. And now we're doing these 6 o'clock pre-streams on where we talked about the last one. We gave you a 30-minute primer on what's happening in Haiti right now, which is another like unbelievably important story that not enough people are talking about. Then, of course, the post games and Sunday shows. So there's a huge amount of content. Interviews in the coming weeks include Nina Turner, will well, I don't know when we're going to release it, but Slavoj Žižek is behind a paywall. Next Tuesday, we're doing next Monday instead of Tuesday. Shahid Buttar is going to be in studio, and who's running as Nancy Pelosi. We all better be supporting him. And the great Richard Wolff returns. And the way it all happens is by you becoming a patron, patreon.com/TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS, and go to the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube and click subscribe. Grab your tickets. We have only a couple of dozen left, I think, maybe even just a dozen, for World Cafe, November 23rd, TMBS live show with Emma Viglin, Crystal Ball, Artesia Balthrop. Matt.
Yeah, folks, check out Literary Hangover. It's on YouTube or on podcast feeds. I just did an episode on the socio-political, economic, all that stuff background of the Salem Witch Trials. And we're going to be doing an Afra Ben episode coming up soon. She was a playwright during the Restoration period of England and also a spy. So psyops and the theater.
Oh,
and,
I like it.
Yeah. So
that sounds very cool. Did you hear my impression when I did the plug for your show on Tuesday?
I did not. No, I should go back and listen to it.
It was actually pretty well received.
I imagine.
And I still managed, I think, to give a more aggressive plug than you usually do.
I'm a soft seller.
You are definitely a soft seller. I think there's a third way in plugs.
If you want it, you can have it. If you don't, just find a podcast that makes you happy. Well, I'm Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I was going to say. What I like. No, I thought it was more like, if you like your podcast, you can keep your podcast.
The John Ossoff of selling podcasts.
If you like your Patreon subs, you can keep them. All right, folks. See you in the Von F.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a lot of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Come on!
Come on!
What?
price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.